Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is going to be a good one.
Good morning, sir. It most certainly is. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Division President with Ashton Woods, Mr. Dwayne Hill. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Chief Financial Officer with Liaison. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Yost Rutten. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Thank you.
Now, can you share a little bit about Liaison? What are you doing for folks?
Yeah, so we're a technology company that focuses on data management, application, and data integration. So we basically help companies move data in and out of their organizations seamlessly. So if you, for example, think of a manufacturing company, they interact with distributors, partners, and suppliers along their value chain. And along that value chain, they exchange data, and all these different stakeholders, they have different applications, they have different data sources, and we help them integrate those. So let those applications talk to each other and let that data flow seamlessly to make sure that the manufacturer can get their product to the right people at the right time. And that's basically what we do.
So when you're talking about kind of dealing with this different groups, is it in, like you mentioned, manufacturing, is it one company that might have offices around the world and then they got to control the data to make sure that it, you know, things don't get lost or nobody steals some of it?
Yes, that's one aspect of it. And we really focus on larger companies that have present around the globe with various locations, but also they often have very disparate systems. They're for example, a result of acquisitions they've done in the past where they have a different ERP system on a different location.
Oh, so they may be totally different and they still have to be integrated?
Correct. And we help with that. But also outside of those companies, right? We let those companies talk to their suppliers, talk to their distributors.
And those could have different systems as well, right?
Absolutely.
So it gets more and more complicated. And then do these companies, they have a difficult time managing that in-house, so then that's why they would work with your company?
You're exactly right. So it's really, as the world evolves, and if you think about it, there are so many more applications, right? Today, if you just look at your phone, how many apps do you have on it? So it's becoming more and more complex for companies to do that stuff in-house, and it becomes more of a burden. So we really do take that away from them and do the heavy lifting for them.
And then you're working closely with the CIOs of the company typically?
Yes. We're mostly successful when we have the conversation at the C level. So with the CIOs, but also the CFOs, right? Because there's a financial impact to this as well.
Sure. Now, are you kind of specialists in any type of software, or you're kind of software agnostic? Like, are you Oracle or SAP, or do you have any kind of preferences in any of that?
No, really, we try to be as agnostic as possible, just because that's sort of the way of the world today, right? Companies are buying, the way they buy software is very different today as they used to do in the past, right? You would buy one big ERP system, for example, from SAP or Oracle, whereas now they buy the basic technology, but then buy various applications to bolt onto that that could be from very different vendors. So for us to be successful, we need to be able to
play with everybody. Right?
Exactly.
Now, what about customization? Do you help kind of customize solutions for them?
You mean in terms of their applications?
Right. So now you have all these disparate kind of software everywhere and you're kind of linking them all together, but does that require you to kind of customize it so it works seamlessly?
Yeah. So the plumbing, if you will, what we do behind the scenes, that's very much, there's a large customization piece to that for sure, but we don't get into the applications themselves, if that makes sense.
Right. Because they stand alone, right?
Right.
And you're always what you call the bolting on or...
Right.
Now, you're new to the CFO role?
I am to the standalone CFO role. So in my previous job, I've been in Atlanta now 6.5 years and five.
All with Liaison?
No. So the last 5 years, I worked for SAP, which is a large German software company. And my last role there, I was a division CFO for SAP SuccessFactors, which is their division that focuses on cloud-based HR solutions. So not completely new to the CFO role, but you know, a division CFO role is obviously very different from a standalone sure. CFO role. So that aspect is new.
Are you enjoying it?
I am so far. I mean, it's been it's been five whole weeks. So
5 weeks.
Yeah, so far so good.
So when you go into a role like this, how do you attack the first like 100 days?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that initially you have to observe and make sure that this company has been around for 17 years. So we're obviously doing something right.
Exactly.
So coming in and changing everything right away is probably not the right approach. So for me, it's really, I'm still sort of in the observing phase, trying to figure out what we're doing right and what I think we can do better.
And then what's your vision?
My take on a CFO role or a finance function at a company as a whole, I think finance should be a vital part of how we run a business and not just sort of a back office role, right? So the way I think about it is, I always use an analogy of the weather, so to speak. We're not in the business of reporting the weather or even forecasting the weather. We're also in the business of trying to figure out where do we need to travel to have the weather that we want, so to speak. So, and what I mean by that is that as a finance organization, we really need to work with our folks in sales, operations, kind of work together with them to see how we can steer the business in the direction that we want it to go. So that's really my focus, I think.
So when you're out there in the marketplace and you're trying to, find new clients, don't they typically already have a vendor that does what you do?
To a certain extent. So I think the way our approach is unique, we just launched a new product called Liaison Alloy. That's our cloud-based platform. And our solution is a bit unique in the sense that we do all the heavy lifting for our customers. We do the data extraction, harmonization, and sending the data around. So the way I think about that in my head a little bit to picture it is our approach is a hub and spoke model, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So our solution is the spoke, a big data repository where all the applications sort of connect to and bolt onto, whereas in a more traditional approach, it's more of a point-to-point model where each application has to be integrated with each of the various applications that it needs to communicate with separately. So there's a lot more room for error. It's a lot more complex and a lot more time consuming. So we have a sort of a unique approach to an existing problem, if you will.
And when you're going to have these conversations with, I guess, other CFOs or CIOs, what's the pain they're having that they're saying, you know what, maybe we should call these liaison folks?
So it's a couple of things. One is, as I mentioned, it's becoming more and more complex. You have more and more applications, more and more data sources, but also compliance and security is becoming more and more of an issue. So for people not to have to worry about that in-house and have another party take care of that for them, that's obviously a huge benefit.
So if somebody had gone through some sort of a breach, that's a, hey, maybe we should rethink the way we're doing things.
Absolutely. That would be a great time to...
Is that how you get a lot of customers? Is when that happens, there is some sort of a crisis and they're like, hey, maybe we got to rethink the way we're doing things?
No, not necessarily. We'd like to be in front of that, basically. But it is a concern that our customers have.
Now, what about if they're about to go through a phase of growth where they're kind of doing a lot of mergers and acquisitions?
That is where we can add a lot of value, right? As I mentioned before, 9 out of 10 times when you do an acquisition, there are, the party you're acquiring are on different systems, have different applications. So, and it takes time to convert them to the applications that you're running. So, the solution that we offer allows them to bolt all that on to an existing infrastructure and let the things talk to each other, basically.
Mm-hmm. And in your career, how did you kind of work your way up to the CFO role? How'd that evolve?
He was a rocket scientist, weren't you?
I was, yes. That's right.
Yeah. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm indeed an aerospace engineer by trade, but I quickly figured out that that wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. It was a great product, very...
You went through like college, university as...
Yes. Yeah, I have a master's in aerospace engineering. So
when you were younger, what was the thought process? What did you dream of?
Actually, I wanted to become a pilot, but my eyesight was just not good enough. So that's sort of what drove me in the direction of aerospace engineering. But I realized that it's really more about the way of thinking that they teach you that you can apply to other things. That has proven to be valuable for me. So I started off in banking out of college, and it worked for a private equity firm, and that's kind of how I slowly rolled into a finance role.
So you went into SAP, and then you worked for a while there, right?
Right. So actually, I joined a company here in Atlanta called SAP, or it was called Ariba at the time, and it got acquired by SAP. So SAP bought Ariba. I was in the finance function there, had various roles at Ariba, and SAP at the time, or still is, pursuing a sort of a cloud growth strategy, and as part of that, we're acquiring a number of companies, one of them being Ariba, but also SuccessFactors and Concur, being part of the SAP cloud finance organization, so to speak, offered me an opportunity to become division CFO of a different division within SAP when that opportunity arose about 2-3 years ago. So
you were aware of Liaison while you were at SAP?
Yes, actually, it was we were a customer of theirs. So yes, I was very much aware of that.
So what counsel, if any, might you have to offer with regard to managing an executive career? Because you mentioned very humbly, this sort of led to this, and then this happened, and then I had this opportunity. But I get the distinct sense that you also put some real intention behind this. And anything to offer the young junior exec trying to consciously, intentionally manage their career on a certain arc?
Well, I'm not sure that you can really manage your debt, right? But there's also always a number of pivotal moments, right, in a career. So I would say that when you feel uncomfortable about things and you feel like you're stepping out of your comfort zone and you're wondering whether or not you should be doing something, that's usually when you should be doing something, because you know, 9 out of 10 people will kind of fall back into their comfort zone and don't take that chance. So that's the advice I would offer.
Now, Liaison was at the HIMSS conference. Were you aware of that? The HIMSS, the healthcare IT?
I am, yes. Yeah, I was aware of that. This was right when I actually joined the company. Yep.
And so you're involved in healthcare. So you're in all industries?
Yes, but healthcare and pharmaceutical, the pharmaceutical industry is a focus area of ours, just because of all the regulation, but also because of the disparity when it comes to patient data, for example.
Since right.
Various doctors, various hospitals, and all that stuff. Letting that stuff talk to each other is a great market for us, basically.
And so whenever there is that kind of combination of security and privacy, compliance, all that stuff, when those words are around your business, then Liaison's should be in the mix of that conversation, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
That's when you call 1-800-YOST.
There you go. I didn't know you had my cell number.
So now, what are you most excited about?
So I think if I look at the reason why I joined Liaison, it's for a number of reasons. One is you know, I believe in the product, our new cloud-based solution, Alloy, and I also believe in the market. As we talked about earlier, I think the market is evolving. This is this is only something that's growing, and I think that the combination of the two, having the right product and having the right market, can be very powerful if we execute right. So working with the executive team and the Liaison team globally on capturing that opportunity, that's what I look forward to the most. So
now, how do you see the, it seems like computer power is increasing and just getting more and more and more powerful, and people's expectations are for faster, faster, faster. How do you kind of combine both of those in order to be secure and private? You know, when the expectation of the consumer is, look, I want you, you know, I just, you know, just see as simple as swiping a credit card, you know, all that has to happen in milliseconds. And then, you know, as a consumer, you expect that everywhere. And sometimes, you know, with privacy issues, it's hard to do that effectively.
It is. No, and that's the challenge we work on a daily basis. And that's why I think it's, that gives us, a reason for existence, right? So to outsource that to an expert like Liaison, that's probably a wise thing to do for many companies.
So how do you just stay ahead of everybody?
We have, you know, you're talking to the finance guy here, but we have some very smart engineers that work on that on a daily basis.
And if somebody wanted to learn more about Liaison, where should they go?
liaison.com, and that's spelled L-I-A-I-S-O-N. So a lot of people forget that second I. And there's a wealth of information on our website, but we're also very active on Twitter, on social media. So we're trying to get our name out there.
Well, Yost, thanks so much for joining us this morning, man. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Can you hang with us while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us Division President with Ashton Woods, Mr. Dwayne Hill. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Stone.
So what'd you learn in that last segment?
What's that?
I say, what did you learn in that last segment?
Well, I'm in home building, so a lot of that was way over my head.
You guys use technology, don't you?
Yeah, we do. It's more complex than people think, but certainly some of the things that Yost talked about were foreign to me.
So Ashton Woods, what are you guys doing for folks? You're home builders?
Yeah, we're a national builder, one of the largest private home builders in the country. And, you know, we build homes, townhomes, condominiums, lofts, all across the country and, you know, in the Southeast and out West.
And then typically you go and develop a neighborhood? Is that the...
Yeah, in many cases we'll find a piece of property. We'll go through the process of getting it approved to be, you know, developed. And there's a whole process that happens on the front.
And that's so much fun, right? Because the neighborhood's adjacent.
It's never
get the
political.
Notes that,
and everyone wants you to come and be a part of their neighborhood,
right?
No, it's... That's a big process in and of itself. And
I'll
you go through what we call the entitlement process to get to a point of being able to develop the property, go through the development process, and then ultimately open up the community for new home buyers.
Now, here in the Sandy Springs area, you got a few developments happening, right?
We've got immediately just around the corner, Aria. Brand new community. We just opened up this past month, and it's unique. It's not like anything you typically see in Atlanta. You know, it's a village style community with a English inspiration, and it's mixed use, which means it'll have a combination of townhomes, single family homes, lofts, retail shops, and restaurants. We put a lot of emphasis around the walkability for the community in Atlanta, you know, is a city you get in your car and you drive everywhere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a little spread out.
Yeah. So this community is large enough in on scale to be able to provide people who live here the ability to come home and walk down the street, have a coffee, maybe a glass of wine, go enjoy dinner, some boutique retail shops that'll be coming in. All those things are in process of coming live in terms of actual retailers and restaurants, but very, very exciting. The amenities in this neighborhood are outstanding, trail system, pools. It's, you know, to start with in this community, when you had something special, because it's very unusual to get 75 acres in the middle of Sandy Springs, you know, with corporate headquarters all around. So we thought we needed to take a little bit of a different approach in how we land plan the community. And so we worked with a company called DPZ, Duane Platts Zybek. Anyone who's spent any time down on the Gulf Coast has been to Rosemary Beach or Alice Beach, Seaside. Those neighborhoods were planned by DPZ. Now, they're an international land planner, so it's not just located, you know, local or in the Southeast. It's across the country and, like I said, international. So we work with those, and you know, they're really the experts in what they call new urbanism and creating this space where you don't just pull into your garage and you're gone and you never see your neighbors. The whole concept around the land planning for the development is to really engage socially for folks to be out in the neighborhood engaging. And so the community land plan was developed around that concept with these guys helping us guide us along the way in terms of working through it. And it's pretty special. Like I said, unbelievable pool, clubhouse. There's a public park that'll be a part of it. That'll be a Sandy Springs park, but about 12 acres of public park that'll be tied into it. So, you know, you can go and engage with neighbors and one of the, you know, the green areas or, you know, at the pool, one of the retail shops or the restaurants, but you can also go and get and be a part of nature. And what's interesting about the community when you drive into it is you're in the middle of, you know, a very urban area, the Sandy Springs has become, but you feel like you're away from it all when you, because it's surrounded right by trees. And part of the land plan that went along with this was to really work with the existing topo of the topography, excuse me, of the land to make it feel, you know, like it was plugged into the community and not that we didn't change it for the benefit of ourselves in terms of the way we laid it out. So really, really special location and a lot of special features about this neighborhood that makes it unique. And it's been a star out of the chute. We sold a lot of homes
already
to begin with. Yeah.
Wow. I see Lee's eyes lighting up because Lee lives, what, like 2 miles from the studio right here in Sandy Springs. You and Abby are kind of getting to the point where you may want to look at.
Are you trying to sell my house? It sounds like.
Well, I know enough about you to know that you're probably going to find this kind of thing very attractive.
Lee is right around the corner.
That's right.
You could walk on.
Now, when is the evolution of home building something that now you are incorporating outside elements like a park, a public park, that you're encouraging people outside of the neighborhood to participate in? Because it seemed like for a while neighborhoods were being kind of enclosed, where this is our neighborhood, and you know, kind of no one else is in.
Yeah, a lot of neighborhoods gated. We don't want anyone else except ours in. No, we really incorporated that as part of, you know, creating a more social atmosphere that not only people in the community could participate in, but people that live in the general area.
Right, because these live, work, play kind of environments seem to be popping up more and more. Is that becoming a trend now?
I think it's a lifestyle choice, and it's so significant in Atlanta because we all understand, living in the city, the amount of time you spend in your car driving from one place to another, and just to go get a cup of coffee, if you don't want to do it at home, you got to get in your car. And traffic is an issue in the city, and so with all those things being so, you know, taking up so much people's time, you know, the idea that I can go to work, and hopefully, you know, with this location, it's close by to a lot of people, so the commute times aren't long. But when I get home, I don't necessarily have to jump back in my car if I want to go. And
right, there might be a restaurant there. There might be a coffee shop. There might be dry cleaner, like some of these basic things that everybody needs.
Absolutely, and that's, you know, I think that's something the city needs and the city wants. And you know, our buyers that live in the area and even outside of the area are telling us that, you know, we want something that we can feel like there's a sense of community. It goes beyond just living in this just this neighborhood. There's other things that we can connect with together and with people outside of the immediate community.
Is that happening outside of Atlanta, or is this like an Atlanta thing?
Well, new urbanism and the concept around it, I think, is happening all over the country. It's not been as prevalent in Atlanta. There have been some developments that have focused on this in the city, both in the suburbs and, you know, closer in. But it's fairly unique, and there's not many of these types of developments in Atlanta.
All right, so let's start talking about customizing Lee's home.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm operating under the impression that there's real opportunity to customize your specific living space. And I'm wondering if there aren't some do's and don'ts for those of us that, you know, this is a once or twice or maybe three times in a lifetime thing that we do, get into a new home like that. Some counsel you might have for our side of the table on looking at customizing our new home.
Well, it's really only limited by your imagination in terms of what we offer. We put a tremendous amount of effort around design and personalization. So on the design side, you know, we like to think of ourselves as globally inspired and locally influenced. We work with designers, you know, all around the country and overseas for that matter, to provide people with an experience when they go to one of our model homes. For something they won't necessarily just see typical in Atlanta. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for personalization. We have a studio space, but we call it the Studio by Ashton Woods. It's about 11,000 square foot of joy from my perspective. And, you know, I've been in home building a long time. So I've been to a lot of these types of spaces, and this place is a true experience for people where they walk in and they're really wild out of the gate. They get tremendous amount of ideas from vignettes that we put together by, you know, international designers to give people, you know, whether your style is traditional and you really, you know, kind of like that's where your home is and you're comfortable, or if you're more towards a transitional in terms of style, or modern, we do that very well, and we show people different ways that they can accomplish that with some of the vignettes. And certainly, you know, we have a following of folks that, you know, they've seen one of our model homes, and they'll go around and get a feel for all the different looks and types of opportunities that we create in our model homes. And then we, you know, we show that again in our studio space. So there's, you know, like I said, it's only limited by your imagination in terms of what's possible and what we can do for our home buyers. And, you know, our studio space, you know, is something that, you know, in the industry, there's a national award that they provide. They compete, you know, different home builders across the country compete in every year. And this year, our studio here in Atlanta won the national 2017 national award.
Wow.
For studio spaces. And so, you know, when you start talking about a place where you go and, you know, make selections for your new home, it's not that kind of place. It's truly an experience. And even people that have been in it longer than me, and not saying something, when they walk in, they're wowed. But our customers really enjoy the collaboration. All of our designers, they are designers who professional designers, and they take kind of the angst and the worry and out of the process of going through and figuring out how I'm going to put my home together and how it's going to be an expression of me. You know, some folks like to say, I want what's in that model. That's just kind of like what I want. And then we have color palettes that we've also put together in the studio for folks that aren't really sure, to give them kind of a direction. We've, you know, also, like I said, have the vignettes in the studio that show different styles. You know, if you want the Italian cabinets, that's a more modern look, in a different texture and color than you might expect to see somewhere typically. We've got that, and we can show you that. If you want heated floors in your master bath or elsewhere, we can accomplish that, and you can go and tactically experience that in our studio. But truly a show place. And so back to the beginning, which is, it's really only limited by your imagination what we can do.
So now the studio is a place that any of your potential customers can go and just kind of use it as thought starters for any of your neighborhoods that you're developing?
All of our customers go through the studio experience. So when they buy a home, or even before they buy a home, sometimes they'll go there just to get an idea
of what's possible.
Of what's possible. And, you know, from countertops to, I mentioned, you know, we've got local cabinetry, we've got Italian cabinetry, every kind of countertop, every kind of flooring that you can possibly imagine, all these different surfaces, you know, from traditional to very contemporary. It's, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words, so encourage people to come and see it.
Well, you had me at heated floors and Italian cabinetry. Let's get Lee's wife, Abby, patched through on the board if we can. I think I've got the... I want these two to talk. I think that Abby's going to love this.
Absolutely.
Ride your bicycle to work.
So now, when you're here in Sandy Springs, you mentioned Aria. Are there other developments happening?
Yeah, around Atlanta, we've got 16 communities currently, and then we have several new communities that we're bringing online. Paces Ferry Park is over in Smyrna, just outside of Vinings. Great location with 67 new townhomes that we're just getting started in. Actually opening up for sales this weekend, so right around the corner from getting that one up and running. We also have Park Haven, that's in Brookhaven, across from Blackburn Park. And, you know, Brookhaven's just a great little suburb.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Folks love that location, and townhomes that we're just beginning to build in there. We also have a neighborhood that we're opening up in the fall in the Peachtree Hills area. It's kind of what I would consider South Buckhead, but anyone who lives down there says this is Peachtree Hills. It's its own little neighborhood, a pretty special location just outside of the city. So, you know, we build from, you know, urban in town, you know, out into the suburbs and, you know, and beyond. Forsyth County, Woodstock, coming all around the city.
Now, Ashton Woods has been awarded a lot of awards about best place to work. Can you talk about the culture of the company?
Well, it's a good question. You know, it's a environment. We do a lot of fun things. We don't take ourselves very seriously. I mean, we take our business seriously, but you know, home building is a tough business. But we make it a lot of fun. We have a lot of outings that we do with our employees. The management's involved with it, you know, right in the middle of it with the team. We do a field day every year where all kinds of goofy things happen. That there's pictures, but I've hidden them. you know, we do great things with our teams and our communities. We do dinners on a quarterly basis with our top communities in terms of the ones that are performing best. The culture is one that just, you know, no one's perfect, right? So, you know, and what we do is complex. Our business is you know, I joke about
a lot of moving parts in your world, aren't
thousands and thousands of variables, components that go into it. So it's complicated. It's not easy. There's a lot of stress involved, but we allow folks to, you know, make a mistake, learn from it and grow from it. And, it happens, you know, that way. And I think the culture really starts from, you know, the top of the organization in terms of how we operate. No one takes themselves seriously. Our CEO is a guy who, you know, hang out with you, crack jokes, and is very laid back, but extremely astute as well. So you've got an environment where the top management of the organization engages with everyone across the board, and we understand the importance of, you know, we have great land positions, but ultimately the folks that build our homes, sell our homes, put all the pieces to in place are the ones that make it happen. And there's a tremendous amount of value and appreciation for what our team does.
Now, as your role as president of the Atlanta division, do you spend most of your time just making sure each of the developments are happening on time? Are you out looking for new developments? Like, what's your day-to-day life like?
It can change in a minute. I'm definitely out involved with new land acquisitions. It's, you know, always looking for that next great opportunity for us in the city. But certainly I'm involved in all the day-to-day operations issues, from something that goes wrong to, you know, recognizing someone who's done a great job for us, every aspect of it, from the purchasing piece of it, the construction, land development, like you said, acquisitions. I cover the gambit, and ultimately I'm responsible for it.
And what do you need more of? How can we help you?
We can always use more great land locations, certainly. But, you know, the trade, you know, in the business, you know, it's the trade bases are really stretched because Atlanta has really exploded over the last several years and coming out of downturn. So we could always use more labor too, you know, more trade, greater trade base. But we've done a good job of really engaging those folks and evolving with them as the business has evolved. And like I said, the home building industry has become much more sophisticated over the last several years and starting to move in terms of sophistication towards, you know, most people think of as a commercial operation in terms of how we run our business.
I would think that for the true tradesman, the true craftsman, that working with you guys, collaborating with you guys, would be very rewarding work.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of fun, but finding the right folks to get that job done is sometimes the challenge, you know, because we do have complex offerings, and you want to have the right people, the right tradesmen that are on the job making that happen the way it was envisioned by the customer.
Now, are you bullish on, obviously, on people buying homes as opposed to renting? How is that kind of, it seems like it's going back and forth where there's a period where everybody wants to rent and then there's a period when everybody wants to buy.
Well, the rental market's hot in Atlanta, and you see apartment complexes going up all over the place, but the economics of it are definitely in favor of home ownership. You know, the benefits of having the tax write-off associated with a mortgage are there. Interest rates are still very low. And even though they crept up slightly in the low fours, it's just unbelievable in terms of what you can get for the money. So, you know, definitely this is my business, so I'm going to be bullish on residential home, you know, owning a home versus renting.
But it seems like the younger people want to have the flexibility and be able to, you know, move to a different opportunity.
That has been true historically, but, you know, we're starting to see that millennial generation really move back into home buying. They're definitely back, and there's, we read articles about it daily, but in our communities we see those folks out looking to buy. So that's definitely changed, and I think, you know, parts of that have to do with just what you know, looking at the economics of it, of renting versus owning, and it makes good sense to own versus rent?
Well, and flexibility can be a little bit of a loaded word. The mechanics and the infrastructure for doing something with an asset that you own, it's a lot. You have a lot more options now, so that that too can be more flexible than maybe it was, you know, for my dad or his dad.
How do you mean?
I mean that you can take an asset and remarket it and get out of it and go to your next thing. There's a lot more options available today than there was. So sometimes I think the word flexibility is a little bit loaded, and they think renting's flexible, owning's not. And I don't think it's quite that black and white anymore. Do you?
No, I don't. I think, you know, Atlanta's a dynamic market. It's a very strong market. And so if something changes in your life, the ability to sell is certainly there.
Yeah. If I got a 1-year lease, I can sell a home within the same year.
Right. And, you know, the ability to build a financial nest egg, part of that is home ownership. And there's flexibility that goes along with having extra coin in your pocket as well.
Right.
That's a different kind of flexibility that provides some good opportunity for folks.
So now if somebody wanted to take a look at one of your properties, so best place to go, website?
Oh, sure. Ashtonwoods.com. ASHTONWOODS.com.
So I want to know where this studio thing is. I'm going to go see that.
The studio is located in Avalon, up just off of Old Milton Parkway in Alpharetta.
Mm-hmm.
You guys should check it out. Let me know. I can get you in anytime.
Fantastic. No, I will. Absolutely. And then the neighborhood we were talking about, Aria?
Aria.
Where exactly is that going to be, and how far out are we looking?
It's just off of Abernathy Road. 400, if you were going 400 north, you'd get off at the Abernathy exit, turn left, or actually you'd circle around on that exit.
Right.
And it's on the west side of 400, just about 3/4 mile on the right.
Oh, you can throw a rock from here.
Yeah.
It's across from the Mercedes headquarters.
Yeah, Mercedes-Benz is part of this overall. I forgot to mention that. Mercedes-Benz North American headquarters is moving to Sandy Springs, and it's part of this overall project. And so really excited about that. And when we initially purchased the property, Mercedes came along, and there was a lot of discussion around that and making that work, but there's certainly a big benefit in having that associated with Aria.
Is Aria on both sides of Abernathy?
It is. There's multiple phases to the community, and we've developed phase one of the north side of the community. There's a future phase that we're getting ready to start now. There's also a central phase on the south side of Abernathy that that's where Mercedes headquarters is building theirs now. Mm-hmm. And there'll be some retail there, restaurants, as well as some rental in that part of it. And then there's another phase on the west side, what we call Aria West, just off of Glen Ridge, that's just to the west of the central piece. So large parcel property, and something for people in different phases of life, from someone who's looking for something small, from 900 to 1,400 square feet, we offer these lofts, townhomes that range from 2,200 square feet to well over 4,000 square feet, and single family homes from, 3,200 square feet to over 4,000 square feet.
Well, color me there for a visit to the studio. And as close as this new place is to the studio, I will definitely be visiting that neighborhood. 3 syllables to keep in mind if you haven't already locked this down: espresso. You think we might get a coffee shop in there? You don't have to say, but just know that that's Stone's counsel.
Absolutely.
And deepest wish.
It's good counsel. Thank you.
All right. Hey, how about hanging with us? We're going to have our millennial correspondent and a guest of his coming up in this next section. Can you hang with us for a minute?
Sure.
All right. Lee, you ready for this?
I am.
We met this young man, it's probably been almost a year ago, at one of our on-site broadcasts promoting a new media property at that time. I have since read almost all of his book. In fact, I have sent Kindle versions of his book to a few of my young friends, and I, at the ripe old age of 53, got plenty out of it. The Millennial's Guide to Making Happiness. Am I remembering that title right?
Yes, sir. That's right.
And after a sandwich and a cup of coffee on your dime, Lee, we talked this guy into becoming our millennial correspondent. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Chris Bush. How are you, man?
I'm fantastic. Thank you, Stone. How are you?
Doing well. So get us caught up. What's been happening in your world since we saw you last?
Yeah, just singing the high praises of my generation, trying to be the evangelist or the Jane Goodall of millennials, helping other generations understand us a little better and empower us is really a big part of it.
Well, this is your first edition of the millennial, what do you call it? Millennial moment? Millennial what?
Yeah, we'll call it the millennial moment. I like that.
All right. So who'd you bring with you?
Yes, this is my friend and colleague, Matt Thomas. Matt is the founder of a company called, or a nonprofit called Brawl for a Cause. And we'll
Brawl?
Get to Brawl for a Brawl Cause. For,
Brawl, like mm-hmm. as in fight?
As in fight, yeah. And the way I like to tell this story of Matt's, how Matt has spent the past 2 years is I get a phone call from Matt about 4 or 5 months ago. I said, Chris, how's all the happiness research going? How's all the millennial research going? I said, great. He said, wow, so you really believe in this this positive psychology science of happiness stuff? I said, yeah, absolutely. I really believe in it. He goes, do you believe in it enough to fight for it?
said, he was like, setting you up, wasn't he?
I can't imagine the scenario where I deck somebody and point at him and go, this one's for happiness. But we'll get back to that in a minute. I'll explain why that conversation happened. If I may, I'd like to introduce my very first millennial segment by sharing some cool statistics about
Lay it
my
on
generation.
Us, man.
All right. So, the millennial generation, right off the bat, definition. We were born roughly from 1982 to 1996. So that makes us about we're roughly in our 20s now. So I say, if you're in your 20s, you're definitely a millennial. If you're outside of that, you may or may not identify as a millennial. Most people don't because the name millennial has become polarized in recent years. But to help clear the air on what a millennial really is and what we face in modern society, I wanted to share some statistics that I've found. So right off the bat, a millennial is somebody who was part of a generation who swallowed $1 trillion in student debt in order to become America's most educated generation ever. So we face 15% unemployment out of college, and yet 88% of us are optimistic about finding a job. And when we don't find a job, we make up our own. 35% of us have a profitable side business. Plus, 81% of us, despite our financial dire situation that we're in, 81% of us have donated money, goods, or services. And according to Bentley University, 75% of us are unwilling to sacrifice family values in order to have career advancement. So for those of you boomers listening, thinking your millennial doesn't appreciate you, they probably do. They may just not show it. So I think in my experience speaking extensively with successful millennials, but also successful empowering baby boomers, I've found that it's easy to rip on millennials because we're the new guys. I think throughout America's history, it's been easy to kind of push down or tease or prod the generation two below you. This is the first time in history that it's been so widely publicized. But when I look at a millennial, I see somebody who's not necessarily better or worse than previous generation. We're just very different in our mindset. But even though we're new to the market and we have a name to make for ourselves, I see us making incredible strides in every industry. Right off the bat, if you checked Facebook today, you're indulging in a product created by a millennial. Same with if you've ever stayed in an Airbnb, again, conceptualized by a millennial. If you saw La La Land,
yeah,
that's a movie that written, directed, and starred in by millennials. So my favorite statistic, and this one really turned some preconceptions about millennials on their head, is that according to a government study, millennials are actually more likely to stay with our employers than the Gen Xers were at our age. So we're a little bit more loyal than some people think.
Well, that stat certainly surprises me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it surprised me as well. So again, we're not any better or worse. I can't say that than any other generation. We're just different. But I see us with this tremendous spring-loaded potential. And I see a millennial, I see somebody with big dreams and huge vision but may not have the financial situation or otherwise the support that they need to make their mark on the universe. And the reason I brought my buddy Matt Thomas in here today is he's a very empowering example to me of a millennial who was, in a way, drifting and was on a more rigid career path before he had a tough conversation with his parents and said, I have a very clear vision for what will make me happy and how I can provide the most value to the people around me, and I want to see it through. So if I may, I'd like to turn it towards Matt now. So Matt, a quick recap of how I introduced you. You once called me and asked me if I would fight for happiness. So let's go back a couple years. Tell me about tell me about where you were 4 years ago.
Yeah, man. Well, first, Stone and Lee, thanks a lot for having me on the show. And I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to tell you a little bit more about Brawl for a Cause and my story. So a few years ago, like Chris alluded to, I was in college. I was pre-law studying history, comparative literature. I've never taken a business class, but I had a few friends in my fraternity that were trying to put together this boxing event. And they wanted to pit fraternity guys against fraternity guys, get them fighting for their fraternity's philanthropy. And we did some serious work on it. We figured out insurance. We figured out how to get USA Boxing to sanction it and send some refs out and make it legit. And long story short, fraternity got kicked off campus. We got our charter revoked. Our social calendar disappeared with it, having nothing to do with the boxing event. But the unfortunate casualty of this this unfortunate event was that the boxing event disappeared with it. So I ended up trying to do it through a philanthropy I got involved with called UGA Heroes. UGA Heroes provides about 70% of the funding for a local nonprofit called Hero for Children. They benefit children in Georgia affected by HIV and AIDS. So I was on the executive board. We were sitting around a table, kind of like we are now, pitching around fundraising ideas. And I was like, hey, how about we literally get people to fight for these kids? We're called Hero. You know, we'll get these heroes in the ring and raise some money. And they liked the idea. So they said, okay, go ahead to work. Like, what do you need? You need a budget. You need insurance. Like, come back to us with a proposal. So the next week, I came back, and they didn't know I already had a lot of that work done. So I had a proposal ready. I had a budget. I had $1 million of insurance. I had a venue in Athens. I went to University of Georgia. So the venue in Athens is the Georgia Theater. And it had burned down when I went to Georgia in 2009, but it had just been rebuilt that year. So it was like the grand reopening. I was like, that's our venue. Like, I want to put a ring on that stage. And so I came back, and I had 10 of my buddies already signed up to fight too. So I'm like, here we go. Like, we got an event. And they're like, oh, wow, that was fast. So maybe we can't do it this year, but how about next year? You keep, you know, doing work, and next year we'll get in the budget and we'll put more resources to this. And I was like, I don't know about that. I was already, it's already failed once and it was about to fail again. I was kind of at a crossroads where I could see this thing that I was passionate about and I'd put a lot of work into fail again. Or I could just try to do it myself. So I started reaching out to potential sponsors. I was 21, so I didn't have any money. I didn't have much experience planning events. It was kind of a tough sell. But I started going into gyms and being like, hey, I got this big group of people ready to fight. They need training. I got this big group of Greek kids with, some money, and they're probably good consumers for you or something. So are you interested? And my first win was the biggest gym in Athens called the Omni Club. They basically have a monopoly over the gym market in Athens. And I sat down across from the owner, gave him my pitch, and he said, you're in luck. 2 months, we're launching a program called Fight Club. And it's designed to get sorority girls in here punching and kicking bags. So this is a perfect coming out party for us. So we'll put our name on the whole thing. And I remember walking in there praying for $1,000. That would knock out about a fourth of my overhead. I walked out with a check for $2,500. I was like, oh, I'm sold. Like, it was such a rush. And the first event, it went well. We sold about 864 tickets. That's almost filling up the theater. I remember my mom called me the next day crying because she saw me in, like, local news. And And that first event, I should have known that about a year later, I'd be a law school dropout. There's no way a courtroom could give me that feeling of creation, of having this idea and then seeing it through to fruition, where people were lining up around the corner to buy tickets to something I came up with in my head. And so to circle back to what Chris was talking about, I did my first semester of law school, and I finished a good standing. My parents were proud of me because I was going to be a lawyer someday. And I had to sit down and tell them, hey, this isn't where my heart is. You know, I'm going into debt to get an education for a profession that I don't want to be in. And I'm realizing that the more and more I learn about this, I love the material, but I don't love the end result. I don't love where I'm going with it. And so instead of going into debt for an education I wasn't going to use, I decided to get paid for an education that I did want. And so I withdrew to join two technology startups. One is called Sales Loft. They started in Atlanta Tech Village. I learned under Kyle Porter, Rob Foreman, and Tim Doerr. I managed their second product, which is now their only product, called Cadence. The week that I joined the company, they were launching Cadence. They hired me in a support role. And I love telling this story because I had the best first week of work ever. It was Labor Day, so Monday was off. So it was already a short week. Tuesday was training and meeting everyone. Wednesday was much of the same, and getting to know my team. Thursday, David Cummings was our big investor. He started Atlanta Tech Village. He has a holding company called Atlanta Ventures. We were a part of that suite of companies, and he did an Atlanta Ventures retreat at his lake house called Chantilly. And so, picture like 200 startup type people all on this lake, around on jet skis and playing on water trampolines. And he even rented one of those flyboards where you're kind of like Iron Man on the water. There's like jets of water propelling you into the air. It's like amazing, first week of work. And the next day, the next morning I come in, I'm kind of like sunburnt from the day at the lake and like maybe a little hungover. And Rob Foreman taps me on the shoulder. He's like, hey, can you join us in the boardroom? It's like, okay. I walk out and Kyle's sitting there, Rob's sitting there. He's like, I see a lot of potential in you. I was like, from the lake? Like, I said, well, we want to know if you want to help us launch this product. We want to build a little company within a company. We think you'd be a good fit for what we're thinking. Yeah, 100% in. Like, that sounds great. It sounds better than support calls. So, so for 6 months, did that. We took it about $175,000 in ARR in 6 months. Learned a ton about software, which was, again, I studied history and comparative literature. My only experience in business was this little charity event that, I did in college. And so this like rocked my world. It showed me this brand new world of technology and entrepreneurship. And so after Sales Loft, while I was there, I was not looking for another job, but a company called Roadie reached out to me. My now boss sent me a LinkedIn message saying, we have an exciting new opportunity with a serial entrepreneur that's going to disrupt a multi-billion dollar shipping industry. And I was like, okay. He was like, just meet us for coffee. Like, here's Alan. So I sat down and I really loved, my boss, like first impression was on point. Definitely a baby boomer, definitely a Gen Xer. Like we come from very different backgrounds, but we saw eye to eye on one important thing, which was changing the world. I truly believe that Roadie will change the world, and they are changing the world. And so they asked me to come back for a second interview and meet Mark Orland, the founder. And as soon as I walked into that interview, I was leaving Sales Loft. Like Mark is such a dynamic CEO. He's such a good storyteller. He's a people-focused leader. And that's the kind of person I want to be. And so we had a 3.5-hour interview. And I joined Roadie the week before we launched. So I was there on launch day, been there for 2 years, worked in every department. And they were Gen Xers that were open to me doing that. When I joined the company, I said, hey, I'm here to learn. I see this as a class and I want to help you start this thing. And your biggest challenge is going to be controlling my energy because I'm going to want to do everything. Mm-hmm. And if you're okay with that, then, I'll make some miracles happen for you. But if you aren't, it's going to be, we're going to have problems.
So Matt, Matt, if I may jump in. So I think what we've just heard is that sounds like a typical path to me as a millennial, that you jump around and you're in these sort of Providence will take over and you'll find yourself in a boardroom slightly hungover and offered a job, or you'll be just in the right place at the right time or meeting the right people, networking. And I think in that, in your history, we've just heard almost three or four different potential career paths in the span of 3 years. And that's very typical for a millennial. And my question, asking on behalf of a lot of the baby boomers listening, is why is it that you didn't feel so gung-ho or empowered by law school, something that could have a lot of potential that I know you're smart, you would have excelled at, and yet you're in this startup environment, arguably making 20% what you could have made as a lawyer. Why is it that you felt so empowered at a startup-like environment with maybe a little bit less security, less stability? And how was it that these older gentlemen you worked with empowered you so much?
It's an awesome question. So I alluded to this a little bit when I was making the decision to withdraw from law school, which was I didn't see the utility in it. I was going into debt to get an education I didn't want when I could be getting paid to get an education I did want. So part of it was like a functional decision of this is going to be more useful in my life. But there are some other things at play too. So growing up, one of the biggest lessons my mom instilled in me was you can learn something from everyone. Every single person, doesn't matter if they're begging for money on the side of the street or if they're a CEO, you know, interviewing you for a job, you can learn something from everyone. And so I've taken that lesson and applied it every job I've had and most every person I've met. And so every job that I walk into, I see as a classroom. Those startup jobs, you know, I was doing work. I was helping the company succeed. But I was getting a lot out of it that wasn't in my offer letter. I was getting to see how entrepreneurs thought through decisions. I was getting to have a real role in building a company and something that will provide value for thousands or millions of people. And those lessons, you can't get in a classroom. So those, you know, instead of, again, you know, burdening myself with debt, to learn a bunch of case law that I could buy a couple law books and probably do pretty well myself. I mean, law school's Socratic method. They're drawing it out of me anyway. I could draw it out myself. But I can't get the kind of entrepreneurial experience that I got at SalesLoft or Roadie without either doing it myself and making a lot of mistakes along the way or learning from guys that have been around the block, like Mark, where it's his fifth company. He's had four exits. They're successful. That's unheard of. His most recent company's Cabbage, valued over $1 billion. He's a unicorn. You're not going to find a law school teacher like that, especially not one that will pay you to be in their class. So it was a no-brainer. Mm-hmm.
And one of the words that kept coming up was classroom, that I think millennials find a lot of value in showing up not to what's just a job, but what's also a classroom. They go in with the mind of, how can I learn today? And that's not necessarily a bad or a challenging thing for somebody like a baby boomer who may be managing that millennial on a daily basis, because the mindset is, how can I learn more to help you, to help me, but also to help you? And as somebody who has coached and managed millennials myself, I notice a distinct hike in energy and positivity when I'm training them something fresh and new. For example, I once trained a sales team of millennials whose job really didn't extend outside of cold emails and cold calls. I trained them how to pitch a product, which is somewhat related, but they found so much value in it that I was instilling something new and fresh and giving them a lot of value backwards for the devotion that they had showed me. So it sounds like what you found a lot of value in is that you're getting basically a free education, which who can blame us? Again, we graduate with about an average $40,000 in debt. Sure, we're going to look for a free classroom anywhere we can find it.
Now, Chris, when we're going to do these segments, is this your vision of it, is to bring a millennial in and let them share their story? Or are you going to bring in some boomers that are the employer and then share their side as well?
Absolutely. I'll bring in both. I have boomers in my network who I think exemplify how to maximize a millennial. They can add a lot of value in that respect. And I've got millennials like Matt who took maybe a slightly less traditional path and have created something amazing out of it. And I think both can serve as diplomats helping us bridge what's become a gap between our generations. But I see too many examples of boomers and millennials working together, creating amazing things, doing incredible stuff, right, empowering each other to let that gap get any wider. So it's my job as your millennial correspondent to tighten the gap.
Now, Matt, if somebody wanted to learn more about Rhody or Brawl for a Cause websites?
Yeah, so Rhody.com, we're both on the Android and the App Store. And it's if you don't know what it is, it's basically Uber for stuff, right? It's instead of transporting people, we transport packages. Mm-hmm. We use the peer-to-peer model, so it's like excess carrying capacity and cars already headed in the direction that items need to go. So if you bought something on Craigslist and you need to get it to your house and you don't have that truck, we're your best friend with a truck. So download the app for that. Brawl for a Cause, didn't quite get into why I was soliciting Chris to literally fight for what he believes in. But what we do is we put on charity boxing events. And instead of actual boxers, we have everyday people like Chris getting into the ring and literally fighting for what they believe in. So they choose a cause. Maybe it's a philanthropy. Maybe it's a book they're trying to launch. They let everyone know, their friends or family, hey, I'm going to get punched in the face for what I believe in. Will you donate? And so we set them up with free training. We set them up with gear. We set them up with social media templates and email templates to fundraise. And then they coordinate their own fundraising campaign while they're training to fight in their very first USA Boxing sanctioned amateur boxing bout. And it's grown up a little bit since the college days where it was a shirtless fraternity, drunken fight fest. It's a little bit more refined now. So we have our events in Buckhead. The last two have been at the Grand Hyatt and the Westin right next to Lenox. We do black tie. It's open bar. We have casino games. So you can gamble while you watch your friends and coworkers fight for what they believe in.
And that's brawlforacause.com?
And brawlforacause.com.
Good stuff. And Chris, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you, maybe they have a company and they want to have you come in and do a workshop for millennials?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is chrisbush.com, and that's C-H-R-I-S. BUTSCH.com. We Germans love our consonants. And my book is called The Millennial's Guide to Making Happiness. If you'd like more insight into my research and also the psychology of a modern millennial and how to maximize us, check out the book. Again, that's The Millennial's Guide to Making Happiness, available on Amazon and Kindle.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton, our producer Ryan Redhawk McPherson. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.